Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Indian Religions, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Sam Wright, who's a visiting professor in the Department of Arts and Sciences at Ahmedabad University. We're speaking about a brand new, exciting book called A Time of Novelty, Logic, Emotion, and Intellectual Life in Early Modern India, 1500 to 1700. It's a brand new 2021 OEP publication. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, from what I understand, you've listened to the podcast a fair bit.
Yes, I suppose I'm a regular listener and I enjoy all the various conversations that you put out there.
That's great. Their pitch to the interested public member in terms of, you know, public education. And I always wonder, you know, how do our colleagues stay stimulated? The questions are so what's your book about? So, but nevertheless, many of our colleagues listen, which is fantastic, actually.
Oh, it's always an enjoyable experience to listen to the podcast.
Great. So, this book is fascinating. I mean, we've covered a number of fascinating books, but this strikes me, I'm in a different subfield, obviously, but this strikes me as a major innovation or intervention in your subfield. Would you agree with that assessment?
I suppose. I mean, I'm trying to put into conversation two aspects here. One is the Nyaya philosophy, and on the other hand, history of emotions. And you know, that comes out of a longer interest of mine that I have had since through graduate school on what it really means to put philosophy and history into conversation. And so, yes, I mean, I was trying to in this book to place them into conversation, to think about what it means for emotion to or play a role in knowledge formation, the meaning of knowledge. And so yes, was trying to do those kind of things in the book.
So you mentioned Nyaya. Your book is about a particular juncture in the history of Nyaya. And Nyaya, for those of you listening, many may already be aware, is one of the classical six astika philosophical schools of ancient India. So how would you characterize Nyaya?
Sure. Well, let me just, maybe I just give a sort of standard overview. You know, Nyaya is presented as one of the six schools of Indian philosophy. And we can think of it, I suppose, we could gloss it as logic epistemology. Its foundational text, its Mula Grantha, is the Nyaya Sutra. And that text has come down to us through anonymous redactors, probably between 200 to 450 of the Common Era. And it's a system of thought that's concerned with large questions: what exists, how do we know, one characteristic or one definition even of it that's been put forward is the examination of objects, examination of things through the valid means of cognition. That's to say, the accepted ways in the system of thought through which we correctly make sense of the world. From those early centuries of the Common Era, up until the 19th century, I would say, there's a very large corpus of texts from commentaries, sub-commentaries, independent treatises, there's major figures in the discipline: Udayana from around 10th, 11th century, Gangesha from the early 14th century, Raghunatha Shiromani from early 16th century in Navadvipa, a figure who I look at extensively in the book. So Nyaya really has emerged out of a large debate context in pre-colonial India. Debates with Mimamsa, with Indian Buddhists. Of course, in the early modern period that I'm looking at, you also have the development of a strong Persian and Arabic logic. Even though it doesn't seem to me that Nyaya philosophers engaged with Persian logic, that's part of the context in which they're writing in. So there's a lot of things more I suppose I could say, but it's a system of knowledge looking at again what exists, what the meaning of knowledge, how do we gain knowledge, those kind of things.
So what sources do you look at for your book? What's your data?
Yeah, so this was this is a good question, because it was a bit of a sticking point for me early on, the amount of works in Nyaya for this period that I'm looking at, 16th and 17th century, is really quite large, there's that question of, well, how am I going to enter into such a large corpus of material? For example, in these two centuries I'm looking at, according to my estimates, we have about 280 works by about 52 authors, and we have about 4,800 surviving manuscripts. So there's a lot one could dive into. And I look at this manuscript culture in the book in chapter 5. But as I look closely at this archive, I noticed that there were a fair amount of works that can be classified as essays, short essays. They're called vadas or vicharas. And these seem to me immediately to be a bit more manageable. They're quite short texts, and they're very much to the point. I mean, they announce their topic really within the first a few sentences. I found them interesting also because at the time when I was trying to put this book together, and it comes out of my PhD dissertation. At that time, I was very taken with the Morellian method, named after Giovanni Morelli from the late 19th century. This method was addressed by Carlo Ginzburg, when he talks about the evidential paradigm in the humanities. And for Morelli, he had this idea that what tells us most about some object of inquiry, and he was interested in artwork, what tells us the most are the details, those areas in an object that are least influenced by one's training, or one's school of thought or affiliation. So he was interested in how people painted earlobes, for example, or fingernails. So I thought that very much that these essays were, so maybe I could read them like that, sort of like the fingernails, the earlobes of the discipline. It would allow me to, I thought at the time, to address the peculiar concerns of philosophers then would allow me perhaps to address better this question of questions that I was interested in about the role of emotion, for example. These materials also hadn't been looked at much. So that was another reason that I took them up. So
these compositions, these vadas, these essays, as it were, can you say a little bit about, as much as we can know, how they circulated or who they were written for? Is this comparable for example, to modern academic papers, and whether it's Purana studies or Nyaya studies, were they written for other exegetes and scholars, or do we have a sense of how they functioned?
It's a little hard to answer that question. I mean, we have to make some sort of guesswork. It definitely seems they're definitely specialized texts. And probably some of them emerged out of the student-teacher conversations where a teacher wanted a student to engage specifically with the topic. Some of them were part of larger works, and they sort of became disassociated from those larger works and circulated as small sections. So maybe only three or four folia. In terms of their circulation, I mean, yes, they did circulate very widely throughout South Asia. And in fact, I do look at this in the book and thinking about how these manuscripts circulated in just such huge numbers through a large number of towns and various scripts across South Asia. Part of why I wanted to look at these manuscripts, especially these Vadas, and how they spread across the region, let's just say across South Asia, is because I was interested in the role of or the place of Bengal in this larger discussion. So my book also makes a claim that Bengal was the sort of essential place of the discipline at this time. And so a lot of the works coming out of Bengal were in sort of in high demand, you might say, through this manuscript economy. And it's through these linkages across the various regions as expressed in the circulation of manuscripts that the Nyaya intellectual space is sort of constituted. And Nyaya philosophers see themselves as part of a pan-regional intellectual space. So,
thank you for the conjecture. Thank you. The book's called A Time of Novelty. Now we know what time this is, and we know school this is. Novelty. Why is this a time of novelty?
Okay. Yeah. This is a good question. So
I would hope so.
I mean, I tried to trace. Let me just back up and say a little bit here that when we look at early modern India, there are of course many philosophical communities at this time: Mimamsa, Vedanta, Bhakti. As I mentioned, the Persian and Arabic philosophy. If we look at the discipline, of course, I'm interested in Nyaya Shastra, but when we look at that discipline in the 16th and 17th centuries, a lot of these philosophers are employing periodizing terms like new, let's just say Navya, or old, Prachina. And these terms are, of course, quite well known, and they've been discussed in the discipline. Previous scholars like Janardhan Ganeri or Sheldon Pollock have argued that these terms indicate a new way of thinking or a new orientation to one's tradition of thought. The argument being that novelty or this newness is at the center of their philosophical project. In the book, I was wanting to sort of explore this further. What does it mean to state that? Overall, then my book is really trying to query that question. It's a long argument on how Nyaya philosophers acted on and behalf of and cared for novelty when reading and writing and debating. And this leads me to make, I guess, sort of some large claims. If we consider a claim by some Nyaya philosophers about a new position, a new conclusion. There's a few subjects that I chart in the book. there might be claims about the ontological status of the objectivity relation, this vishayata, or it might be a new definition of doubt, for example, or it might be the claim that there is that happiness exists in Ishvara. But these are all labeled as new positions. There's a debate around them. And so my argument is that when we think about how those claims are put forward, there has to be sort of a purpose behind them. There has to be an object or some sort of communicative force that allows a reader to direct their attention to an object. It's when they're reading claims about the new authors say X or the new authors say Y. So what I'm thinking then about is there is about how certain objects emerge out of the claim that something is new. So what am I really saying here? I'm trying to in the book I end up using David Shulman's arguments on the power of imagination. So for Shulman, who reads philosophical and literary texts of South Asia to make his argument, right, imagination is able to bring some object from a potential existence into an actual existence. And it does this through a generative process based on an initial sense perception. And that intensifies, that initial experience can intensify when we I sort of care for, do we cast our attention onto it to such an extent that it can alter reality. So I argue that when the term new, when that term new is heard or read in the text or debated, it actually transcends this initial activity of reading it or hearing it in a debate and forms the basis of a generative process in the context of Nyaya. And that sort of makes, in this process, this makes real and makes nameable a certain object. That's to say, it makes real and makes nameable these Navyas as new philosophers. And so when they're recognizing novelty, that's to say, recognizing specific instances of the new within these philosophical texts, that recognition is a process of a care-filled and imaginative process whereby a community is brought into being. But to get to your, come all the way back to your question of what is this a time of novelty? What are we talking about here? I think that unlike our modern biases, this is not a time of novelty in which the new sort of replaces the old, but it's a moment when the new and old sort of coexist together, they're coeval. And that's what I term a synchronic novelty, where the new emerges along with the old, and indeed the old can't exist before the new. So there's this synchronic novelty is what I'm arguing is really the form of novelty that we see expressed here in this period in 16th and 17th century by Nyaya philosophers. And I suppose we could make an even larger claim that that perhaps synchronic novelty is the form of novelty expressed across the history of philosophy. So
the idea that the new in this context, you know, consciously new, referred to as Navya, the idea that it is examined in concert with the old, that idea resonates because, you know, the Hinduism house is continually renovated, never demolished, right? This is just the texture of the tradition and part of why it's so difficult to define and part of why it's been alive for so long, because we never, you know, it doesn't get rid of anything. We'll take that too. Great. Add that on. Why not? Please go ahead.
No, I was just saying that, I mean, just to sort of fully, maybe even more fully answer your question, we do see
that would be nice.
We do see cases where what is being argued as new is actually not new. It's sort of repackaged, and as there's a new philosophical history argued for a certain term, and that's also quite fascinating. And at this moment, that sort of these minor tangential, these minor views that have existed perhaps in the tradition prior to this period reanimated and given this ascribed a newness, when in fact they're quite old positions. That's also an interesting part of the way in which newness is expressed in this period.
And why is this being done?
Yes. I mean, my answer in the book is that why somebody like Gadadhara Bhattacharya or his teacher Harirama Tarkavagisha would do this, and they do this specifically in the case of Vishayata, this objectivity relation, which is how the external objects in the world actually link to our internal cognitions of them. I think the purpose here, why this is being done, is to narrativize a philosophical reality so that the new is presented as the now of Nyaya philosophical history. It's sort of creating a culmination of the new into this moment, into this the now of Nyaya philosophical history, and allows, even if we take it further, very intimate relations with readers of their work or with those who are debating their work. So if everyone is sort of coming along with Gadadhara and Harirama and accepting this newness, this new view, then they also accept that the new contains a specific version of philosophical reality. And then it helps to coalesce a community around certain intellectual commitments and certain emotional commitments at the same time.
The last thing you mentioned was going to be my next question. What does emotion have to do with this newness? Or what does this newness have to do with emotion? You know, what is the role of emotion? Why is this so important?
Right. Well, I mean, first I should say that I think history of emotion is a powerful lens when brought into conversation with pre-colonial intellectual history of South Asia. It's something that, you know, we don't have much work in it, I suppose, for the pre-colonial period, but in the colonial India, for example, Margaret Parnell's work was influential for how I thought about framing my own thinking around the role of emotion here. It was important for me because I think that while emotion is the activity of our inner life, right? And that's the definition that I'm taking from Jagannatha Pandita Raja from mid 17th century Banaras. But I wanted to try to bring emotion out into the philosophical world, as to say, that it had a large role to play in knowledge creation. So I should say that this is why I use the phrase in the book, affective novelty, as a counterpart to intellectual novelty. So affective novelty is the collection of emotional practices that occur alongside the new, along with this new knowledge. Really is used there to stress that the dynamic ways in which philosophers created planned relations with the philosophical world. I think that's the role of emotion that I'm trying to bring out in the book.
How did you get interested in this subfield? How you know, whereby did you bring these two into conversation?
I suppose it's hard to sort of pinpoint an answer to that question or sort of a moment. The project emerged out of a long process through my graduate work. I knew early on that I wanted to work on Nyaya in this period, in this 16th and 17th century. It's funny, right before I was going into graduate school thinking about Nyaya, my brother gave me a book that had an essay in it by Quentin Skinner, his well-known essay, Meaning and Understanding in the History of Ideas. And I became very influenced by this essay about how, you know, what does it mean to read philosophy and history together? How do they overlap? That's why in the book, for example, I try to draw on a fair amount of historical documents and secondary sources in Bengali, because as Bengal is really the premier intellectual center of Navya, Nyaya Shastra here in this at this moment, more so even than Benares, there's a lot of writing on Nyaya in Bengali and some important primary sources. So I had always had this interest in connecting Nyaya philosophy with a historical context. I just wasn't quite sure how that would sort of work out, what direction that would take. And so I do have to admit, it took me a while to realize that what I really wanted to do was to think about the place of emotion in the way it was constitutive to the meaning of Nyaya philosophical knowledge. And that's sort of what I wanted to explore. So it sort of just sort of snowballed from there when after I started thinking about it. Maybe I'll just stop, pause there. But that was...
Oh, that's fine. You can continue if you like.
Okay.
No, please do. Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks, Raj. no, I mean... As I said, I was very interested in Quentin Skinner's work and things and this contextualist reading of philosophy. But I had always maintained a sort of ambivalence that philosophy would be reduced or was potentially reduced to its economic or social context, et cetera. And what I found fascinating about emotion was that I found it to be, while it was in another context, it didn't abstract from the text. I felt it brought a context of the sort of lived experience of these Nyaya philosophers, and so was a context that was not adjunctive to the text, but really constitutive to its meaning. And so that idea sort of interested me, and that's what I guess I tried to explore in the book more.
You mentioned David Shulman in passing, and in my view, one of the reasons why his writing is so captivating, I mean, there are a number of reasons why writing is captivating. I mean, certainly there's a command of language, there's a lucidity of turns of phrase, but scholars like he write, or they craft their arguments in such a way that that they're always aware of the human experience. They never quarantine the intellectual realm from other parts of self, because we are wholes. While we have perhaps physical bodies, intellectual bodies, emotional bodies, spiritual bodies, we're wholes. And so I think when one is able to acknowledge and discern other dimensions of self in sound intellectual work, it makes that work all the more captivating, in my view.
Yeah, I would 100% agree on that. And I mean, really, that was part of the fascination for writing this book, was thinking about, okay, well, the Nyaya philosophers are arguing for a certain view on doubt, but how is that going to then bring us into this, or try to address this question of what does it mean to be a Nyaya philosopher at this moment? What does it mean to be?
Why does it matter? Writing? Why should we care?
Yes.
Why does anybody care?
Yeah.
Scholars toil to produce their works, and this is the link. Why should we care about this book? Why should we care about this research? Not to imply that there is no reason to care about it, but to prompt folks to bring to the fore why this is important, whether they realize it or not. Yeah. And so that important, there's a saying that comes to mind, and I keep it in mind, especially when I'm teaching undergrads. Nobody cares how much you know unless they know how much you care.
I like that. I mean, that was that. I like that a lot. I mean, that kind of framing, I think, also really carried with me in through writing this book, because writing on Nyaya, you can end up feeling like you're sort of in this cold technical world, right? And it's really
you're a bot. You're...
I mean, because a lot of times the language feels right at the limits of ordinary language. It becomes very artificial language at times, feeling like that. But I always wanted to maintain this perspective that, you know, philosophy and the ideas discussed can be made part of the narrative of our lives, you know, made to fashion our world in some way. And so even in this cold climate of Nyaya, I wanted to bring that discussion to the fore as well. And this perspective on emotion helped me to do that.
Well, certainly, however, and you well know I'm not in your subfield. I work on the lowly Puranas. however we interpret what Navya or what this newness, this very self-conscious newness is, however we interpret philosophically, clearly as human beings, there would be some sort of excitement, sense of adventure. There would be some sort of emotionality around this is, you know, Nyaya 2.0. You know, this is, there would have been, this is more than the slicing and dicing of ideas, right? Or epistemological claims. This has to do with identity formation. This has to do with being conscious of your moment in history, right? In relation to tradition, however you define that. So this is an important word, right? Yeah. Tell us how the book's structured for those who are considering getting it.
Well, yeah. I suppose it has the 6 chapters there, intro and conclusion. And there's quite a long appendix also, because comes out of chapter 5, where I try to, you know, after working through some of the sort of nitty gritty of some of the ideas and things, I want to come back and ask a broader question about how we think about Nyaya intellectual space. That's to say, space across all of South Asia, because the manuscript culture and production is seen all across South Asia. So the chapter 5 then contains some maps and things that where I have worked through a variety of surveys that list the fine spot of the manuscripts that they have surveyed. And a lot of these are colonial artifacts, these surveys, so they're coming from 1860s, 1880s. So they're a bit later than actually the period I'm looking at, but I can't get earlier than that. So the maps show to the reader where this spread of manuscripts occurs across South Asia. And the appendix includes the authors and things and the location of those where those manuscripts are according to author. So in that sense, the book really, I start with trying to think about the relationship between the argument for newness and the ways in which that argument, those arguments for newness or new conclusions, novel positions, brings about a cohesiveness of philosophers. Not all Nyaya philosophers adhere to new positions. Some make new arguments more than others. And so I'm trying to think about how the community sort of forms on the basis of certain arguments. And the second section of the book is looking at how then Nyaya philosophers really how they read space, or read their places through emotions. I'm looking at Bengal, particularly Navadvip, which is the major intellectual center there. And in the final section, I'm looking at space and time, thinking about, again, this spread of manuscript culture in chapter 5 and chapter 6, thinking about how newness contains a temporal history or a a narrative of philosophical history that we can maybe unpack a bit more. So that's sort of very broad brushstrokes for how the book is structured.
That's sort of what we do here on the podcast, the 30,000 foot view. You know, anyone who wants to, you know, and jump out and parachute down, they're welcome to, but we're looking at the broad strokes. Who's the book for? Who might be most interested in reading the book?
Well, I mean, I thought if you're interested in Nyayashastra, this would be a book to look at, or Indian philosophy in general. I try to speak to broad concerns there. Again, if you're interested in how the history of emotions could be used to think through its connection to intellectual contexts, we would find the book interesting, I hope. Just in general, about the various contexts that one finds in early modern India related to engagements with Banaras and Kashi as a place of spiritual liberation. It takes up a long chapter, chapter four. So there's questions around religious studies there, religious history. Maybe I'll just say one more another thing, Raj, about
please.
you know, this is again another very broad point about the book, but I think it's an important point to make, which is that the title is A Time of Novelty, and I'm very serious about it's a time of novelty. It's not the time of novelty. I think that's important to stress. And the distinction is important for me because I'm not claiming in the book that this is the first time that periodization in the discipline of Nyaya takes place, or that it's the first time that terms like Navya, et cetera, Prachina are used. Periodizing terms were used by Gangesha in the early 14th century, who was based in Mithila, and also before that. What I'm saying here is that, and what I argue in the book, that there are potentially many multiple times of novelty in Nyayashastra or in other intellectual disciplines. But each time of novelty would require its own historical and philosophical treatment or excavation, if you will. What makes the 16th and 17th century a time of novelty will not be the same as what makes the 14th century a time of novelty. So that frame informs how I'm writing in the book. I'm not seeing it as some sort of culmination into a novel moment, but rather investigating how the new is constituted in this period without assuming a teleology to that novelty.
Fascinating. Was there anything else about the book that you hoped we would touch on?
I feel like we've covered a fair amount.
Mission accomplished.
It was a pleasure to write, but also very challenging sometimes. So, but I'm glad it's just wonderful to be able to speak with you about it. And
Birthings are painful, yeah.
Yes,
but fruitful and worth it. And it was a pleasure speaking with you as well. I'm glad you've heard the podcast before, so you knew what you were getting into. You didn't require too much priming. Or cajoling.
No, I was very happy to speak, and it's a pleasure to meet you and to be able to chat about the book. And I look forward to listening to the additional podcasts that you put out.
Yes, likewise, it was a pleasure. Just for my own curiosity, is this something? This is an area that you are continuing to research.
I don't think I'll ever get Nyayashastra out of my brain. System. I think it'll be something that I
you have an emotional attachment to Nyaya.
Yes, I do definitely for good or for bad. So I'm interested in sort of expanding a little bit on chapter two, the way in which they're theorizing this connection between mind and world is something that's fascinating me still, and I want to maybe work on that a bit more. I am also interested in how Nyaya philosophy might be able to speak to the climate crisis, and that's kind of an ongoing interest of mine, but I'm not really sure how I would frame it yet. It's interesting to me to try to be able to recover philosophical ideas from the early modern period and see in what ways they might be able to help answer questions that we have today about pressing problems that we're grappling with.
Excellent. But what comes to mind regarding your interest in harnessing your research for the climate question, climate crisis? If I'm not mistaken, there is a proposed topic for the upcoming AAR. It might be the Hinduism unit, or it might be the SARI, the newly named RISA is now SARI unit. And they're looking for proposals, if I'm not mistaken. So perhaps you can submit. In either case, I suspect we will speak again one way or another.
That would be great. I would really look forward to that.
Great. Thank you for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Raj.
For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Samuel Wright, who's visiting assistant professor at Ahmedabad University. We've been speaking with him about his brand new OEP monograph, A Time of Novelty, Logic, Emotion, and Intellectual Life in Early Modern India. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating the marriage of emotion and logic. Take care.